From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. Though Olympic gold medalist Jackie Joyner-Kersee is doing her best to convince Chicagoans that the 2016 Olympic Summer Games belong in their neighborhoods, many residents have been resistant. Ahead on Only a Game, we'll have that story. Also, a recollection of last year's amazing Nadal-Federer Wimbledon final, and the U.S. men's soccer team reasserts itself on the world stage. Also ahead, kayak polo paddles into the pools of Nebraska, where Huskers slowly take to the concept of the wet exit.
It's kind of like learning a nice, smooth golf swing, except for you're underwater and you can't breathe and everything's upside down. So,
but other than that, it's pretty simple.
Yeah, right.
Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. The annual reassembling of NBA basketball teams is in progress as we speak. Thursday night's draft and the trades that preceded it gave fans a sense of who would be wearing their team shirts in the fall, though the Cleveland Cavaliers had already ordered home and away jerseys in Shaq Diesel quadruple extra large before the draft. Joining me now to help determine which teams got better and which ones defied all logic by taking four point guards is Kevin Hench of FoxSports.com. Kevin, welcome back to the program.
Good to be here, Bill.
Talk of this week's NBA wheeling and dealing must begin, I think, with the news that Shaquille O'Neal will be joining LeBron James in Cleveland. The Cavs gave up very little to acquire the loquacious yet aging Big Aristotle. Does this trade significantly change the balance of power in the Eastern Conference?
Absolutely. I think the Cavaliers needed so little to push them over the top, and they got a whole lot. I know that for the last few years there's been talk that Shaq doesn't have much left in the tank, but he had a great season last year. He shot a career-high 61% from the floor, and he got his free throw percentage up to almost 60%, which is the best he's done in 6 years. And they gave up so little to get him that I can't believe they couldn't have pulled this off last year, which would mean they were defending their title going into next season because they were so close. So they're obviously kicking themselves for not making the move. They made it a couple months too late, but I think Shaq makes them the prohibitive favorite to win the championship next year.
Another big trade was the one that saw the New Jersey Nets shipping Vince Carter and Ryan Anderson to Orlando for Rafer Alston, Courtney Lee, and Tony Battee. The Magic, of course, made the finals this year. Will this move help them get over the top in 2010?
This is a wild move. You know, the Magic, obviously, very close. They could have won that series against the Lakers, and I felt like they were way too close to blow things up the way they did. I mean, they're not going to re-sign Turkoglu, almost certainly, it seems now. And Vince Carter is a wild card. I just, chemistry-wise, I don't like the move.
There have been trade rumors this week involving Boston's starting point guard, Rajon Rondo, as well as some odd accusations flying between Celtics general manager Danny Ainge and Rondo's agent. What have you heard about what's going on in Boston as the Celtics try to assemble yet another championship-caliber roster?
There's clearly something about Rajon Rondo that Danny Ainge doesn't like. It can't be the fact that he almost averaged a triple-double in the playoffs this year, because I would assume every GM likes that. But apparently, Rondo has a tardiness problem, and clearly Danny Ainge, as one of the great pure shooters in NBA history, doesn't like the fact that Rondo doesn't need to be guarded in the half court during critical junctures of playoff games. But that said, you do not announce that out loud on the radio if your goal is to trade him. I can't believe that a GM actually went on the radio and said that his point guard, his star point guard, was responsible for losing the series to the Orlando Magic because they didn't have to guard him in the half court. If he has no intention of trading Rondo, then it's excusable. But if he is actually trying to deal him, then you don't denigrate your own product.
Thursday's NBA draft generated less than the usual buzz. Was this because, rather than being the coming out party for 20 or so NBA-ready players, it was the coming out party for, say, one?
Precisely. You know, I had the good fortune or misfortune of spending part of my youth in the Caribbean, and when we would swim out in St. Thomas, you could look down as you were swimming with your mask on, and you could see the floor, and then after you got about 100 yards from the beach, the floor would disappear, and you couldn't see the bottom. That is the drop-off between Blake Griffin and the rest of this NBA draft class. It is the Mariana Trench. It just vanishes. And I know people are trying to make the case for Ricky Rubio, but when you are comparing a guy to Pete Maravich and Steve Nash, just think about how many championships those guys won. When people say that Ricky Rubio's limitations are shooting and defense, I really don't think he's going to turn a franchise around. So I think it's Blake Griffin and not much else.
Many had assumed that the new Minnesota general manager, David Kahn, would bring a slightly more stable approach to the running of the Timberwolves after 15 years of weirdness from former GM Kevin McHale, but the team selected five guards and a Dutch guy with its bevy of picks. What was the thinking there?
Well, there must be a plan B, right? Because you can't play Ricky Rubio and Johnny Flynn together unless the plan is to lose your annual 60 games. And by the way, neither of these guys is a can't-miss point guard. So there is definitely a madness in Minnesota that needs to be figured out with a secondary move, because if they go into the season planning to play both those guys 30 minutes a night, that's going to be a disaster.
Were there any other selections on Thursday that had you scratching your head or conversely nodding your head and saying, oh, yeah, they're going to get better?
One pick I really like was the Nets at number 11 taking Terrence Williams out of Louisville. I think that guy is a legit player, and I think he will help. And I think, you know, there was a little addition by subtraction by getting rid of Vince Carter.
One of my favorite moments of the draft was when Brandon Jennings, who for some reason watched the proceedings from a Manhattan hotel room rather than from within Madison Square Garden in the green room where everybody else was, bolted through Commissioner Stern's little commissioner door about 20 minutes after he'd been selected at number 10. What was your favorite?
Well, that was a good one for sure. I mean, I like the fact that his agent didn't have enough confidence to have him in the room for fear that he would slide too far down and suffer embarrassment. But then once he sort of got the stamp of approval, it was get in a cab, get over there as quickly as possible. Other than that, I guess the one moment that was sort of entertaining as always is the New York fans. Once they didn't get their guy, Stephen Curry, the Warriors took him at number 7. It didn't matter who the Knicks took. Mm-hmm. They were going to boo lustily because they didn't get their guy. So through no fault of his own, Jordan Hill begins his career with the Knicks by getting showered with boos for no reason whatsoever.
Kevin Hinch writes about the NBA and other sports for FoxSports.com. Kevin, thanks very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Bill.
Last week in Lausanne, Switzerland, Rio de Janeiro, Tokyo, Madrid, and Chicago presented their bids to host the 2016 Summer Olympic Games. Recently, Chicago's bid committee has been pulling out all the stateside stops to increase the chances of bringing the Games to the Windy City. But not everyone there wants Chicago or the state of Illinois to risk the millions of dollars it would take to sponsor a 3-week event. From Chicago, Yolanda Perdomo has the story.
On a sweltering summer day in Chicago's Washington Park, hundreds of kids anxiously wait behind an orange archway. On a stage next to them stands Olympic gold medalist Jackie Joyner Kersee.
Runners, take your mark!
The short sprint was one of hundreds of worldwide events to commemorate Olympic Day, which the IOC touts as a day to celebrate the Olympic spirit. Joyner Kersee, who's from East St. Louis, Illinois, wants the Games to come to Chicago.
You know what? I'm an optimist. I think that when it all works out, that everyone's going to see this is going to be, you know, great for, you know, the city of Chicago, great for the economy, and great for the Olympic movement. You know, and I just hope and, you know, and pray that we are awarded the 2016 Games, you know, because everyone can always, you know, see the negative side, but I'm an optimist, and I'm going to stay positive.
But there's outrage echoing from City Hall to the neighborhoods where the Games could displace residents. And there's concern regarding the amount of money taxpayers would have to put up for the Games.
When I say no, you say gang. No! Gang. No!
Last April, the IOC visited Chicago, and several hundred protesters gathered downtown to voice their anger about the millions of public dollars that would be committed to the 2016 Games. Thousands have been laid off in the city and across the state in the last 9 months. The state of Illinois has promised $250 million, and the city another $500 million for the Games. A group calling themselves No Games Chicago organized the rally and is watching the Chicago 2016 organization. Bob Quellis says that money could be better spent elsewhere.
Why not take that $500 million and actually give these people their jobs back and actually be able to maintain those public services? I don't understand why would we be throwing $500 million at the Olympics at this point in time. Given the economic crisis, we actually have other things to take care of.
Last week in Lausanne, Switzerland, representatives from the four bid cities presented their plans to the IOC. The governments of Brazil, Japan, and Spain all promised to cover everything associated with the Games, including cost overruns that, if past Olympics are any indication, could run into the billions of dollars. Chicago's Mayor Richard M. Daley stunned many when he signed off on a similar promise while in Lausanne. Back home, Chicago Alderman Manny Flores said, not so fast. He's drafting an ordinance to hold the city to its initial $500 million pledge.
From the very beginning, we were informed that there would be no taxpayer dollars needed for this. And then we were informed, well, we need to set some money aside because the IOC has called for some skin in the game. That's the way it was referred to us. This is considered insurance. This is considered insurance. So, you know, my view is that given that we have already made a commitment of $500 million, our city has done more than enough.
Chicago 2016 chairman Patrick Ryan says the worries of taxpayers are unfounded because the money will come from the private sector. He says the organization will present its plan to city lawmakers in the coming months.
No, it doesn't come from taxpayer dollars. It's coming from private funding that will protect it, so there won't be money coming out of taxpayer dollars. So we're going to have everything so it's totally transparent.
President Barack Obama recently opened an Olympics office, and some think he'll make a late summer pitch to the IOC to seal the Chicago deal. In the meantime, Lawndale resident L.B. King says that despite the promises of jobs and infrastructure improvements, it may not be enough, and adds that she hopes someone will listen to neighborhood concerns.
I understand that huge global impact. But when we're at the micro level, and you're the one that's going to be directly affected, it's like an ant screaming at an elephant, move out of the way.
The International Olympic Committee will make their anticipated announcement for the winner of the 2016 Summer Games on October 2nd in Copenhagen. For Only a Game, I'm Yolanda Perdomo in Chicago.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. In 2006, the National Collegiate Athletic Association told the College of William and Mary that although their teams could be called the Tribe, the school's feathered logo was demeaning to Native Americans and had to go. Ever since that decision came down, the school has been looking for a new mascot. One of the more recent suggestions is an asparagus stalk. The school's president will make the final decision regarding the mascot. Those favoring the asparagus stalk hope consideration will be given to the fact that if covered with cheese, the vegetable logo would, in fact, represent the school's colors. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, the author of a book about the greatest tennis match of all time justifies applying that designation to Nadal Federer at Wimbledon last year. But first, Tomorrow, a soccer game in South Africa will determine the winner of the Confederations Cup. The team from Brazil will face the team from the United States, and it will be the men's team. Joining me now from South Africa to discuss how they got to this lofty perch is Grant Wall, who writes about soccer for Sports Illustrated. Grant, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thanks for having me, Bill.
The Confederations Cup is sort of a warm-up for next year's World Cup finals in South Africa, at least as far as the host country is concerned. But the tournament has some cachet of its own as well, doesn't it?
It does. I would call this the third most important soccer tournament in the world for national teams, behind only the World Cup and the European Championship. You could make the argument that the Copa America in South America might have as much importance, but I actually think the Confederations Cup has become a quadrennial tournament that is slightly better.
After the U.S. team had been beaten badly by Italy on June 15th and then thoroughly by Brazil 3-0 two nights later, how likely did it seem to you that the U.S. would get through to the semifinal round?
Almost impossible. The odds against the U.S. even getting to the semifinals were astronomical because they needed to win 3-0 against Egypt in the final game of the group stage, and at the same time have Brazil beat Italy, the World Cup champion, 3-0 as well. That just wasn't going to happen, and amazingly it did. It's one of the all-time against all odds results in U.S. soccer history, and for the U.S. to follow that up by turning things around and upsetting Spain was just incredible.
Well, that, of course, is the next thing to talk about. In the semifinals, the U.S. beat Spain 2-0. Did the U.S. do a lot of things right, or did Spain just do a lot of things wrong?
Actually, I think the U.S. did a lot of things right in this game, and that's why I would call this the most impressive victory in the history of U.S. men's soccer. I don't think it was maybe the most important because it didn't happen at a World Cup, but impressive simply because Spain was this juggernaut, running over teams all over Europe, won the European Championship last year, had 15 straight wins, and had gone 35 games without a loss. This team hadn't even lost in 3 years, and the U.S. was the team that ended the streak. So it was just a truly stunning result, in large part because the United States didn't play bunker ball. They came out to play, scored a goal in the 27th minute, did defend well and stopped several Spanish chances, but the U.S. deserved to win this game. And that's got to be encouraging for U.S. soccer fans.
Okay, Italy, the defending World Cup champion, went home after the group stage. Spain, the defending European champ, is out, courtesy of the U.S., so it should be smooth sailing for the U.S. tomorrow in the final, right?
It's going to be even harder than the Spain game, I think, in large part because Michael Bradley, the coach's son, who's had such a good tournament in the defensive midfield, is suspended after getting a semi-dubious red card late in the game against Spain. That's going to really hurt the U.S., and it's going to put a lot of pressure on probably Benny Failhaber, a Brazilian-born player who came to the U.S. when he was six, and has had a pretty good tournament, but he's never been in a pressure cooker like the one he'll be in tomorrow. He's going to have to have an amazing game for the U.S. to have a chance to pull the upset.
Grant, you and numbers of other soccer writers have been piling on the superlatives in terms of the performance of the U.S. team in this tournament. What does it tell us, though, about how good this team really is at this point?
Well, it's hard to know for certain. You can't extrapolate this performance and say the U.S. is going to threaten to win the World Cup next year. What you can say is the U.S. is capable of competing against the best teams in the world and even beating them, as they did against Spain. But there's been a ton of inconsistency in this tournament. The U.S. played pretty well against Italy in that 3-1 loss in the opening game, but really played poorly against Brazil in the second game, and almost looked like school kids out there. They were nervous, timid. It really looked like an almost un-American team in the sense that Americans are rarely fearful in any area. And so for the U.S. to come back and play so well against Spain and play with confidence, perhaps that's the real U.S. team, but we're going to find out in the Brazil game and as we move toward the World Cup next year.
Okay, just by way of reviewing the unlikely circumstances, the U.S. beat Egypt by 3 and Italy lost by 3 when precisely that had to happen. You were among those characterizing that combination of results as one of the most remarkable nights in American soccer history. And then, of course, the U.S. upset Spain when nobody thought that would happen. I wonder, is there any point in asking you for a prediction regarding tomorrow's game against Brazil?
I haven't been able to predict anything in this entire tournament with accuracy, so it's pretty hard. I think I can make a safe prediction saying that the U.S. will not get blown away by Brazil. I just have a hard time envisioning that happening. I think the U.S. is a proud team and doesn't want to have a repeat of what happened in that first game against Brazil. And they have a chance in a final here. The U.S. has never been in a final game of a major FIFA tournament on the men's side. And this is a historic opportunity to raise a trophy in front of the world and say, we can play this game.
Unlike some other sports played in the U.S., soccer broadcasts are not always easy to find, but tomorrow's final between the U.S. and Brazil will get national television coverage.
And that's a real improvement over, for instance, the 1995 Copa America. The U.S. beat Argentina, got to the semifinal against Brazil, but I think you need some special satellite to see the game because nobody really televised it in the United States. Things have changed now, and this game is becoming much more of a mainstream sport in America. The World Cup certainly is a big mainstream event now. And slowly over time, it sure seems like American soccer is starting to be a real presence.
Grant Wall writes about soccer for Sports Illustrated, and he joins me from time to time to talk about same on Only a Game. This time it was from South Africa. Grant, thanks very much.
Thank you.
At Wimbledon yesterday, some observers were shocked when Roger Federer lost a set to Philippe Kohlschreiber, but Federer won the fourth and final set of that match 6-1. He remains the favorite to win the tournament, and if he does, he'd become the first man to win 15 Grand Slams. Elsewhere in Friday's action, Serena Williams defeated Italy's Roberta Vinca 6-3, 6-4, and Elena Dementieva defeated fellow Russian Regina Kulikova 6-1, 6-2. Today, Venus Williams, seeded third, will play Carla Suarez-Navarro. Andy Murray of Great Britain will take on Viktor Troicki, as well as the challenge to succeed in front of home country fans that always confronts Brits in this tournament. Murray, who would be the first British player to win Wimbledon since Fred Perry did so in 1936, was informed by Queen Elizabeth's people that Her Majesty would be available to present the Wimbledon trophy to the winner, so no pressure there. The withdrawal of Rafael Nadal due to injury before the tournament began no doubt disappointed fans who had hoped for a repeat of last year's men's final, in which Nadal beat Roger Federer. No less an authority than John McEnroe said that match was the greatest ever. Perhaps that's what provoked L. John Wertheim to write Strokes of Genius, subtitled Federer, Nadal, and the Greatest Match Ever Played. From the studios of NPR New York, the author joins me now. John, welcome back to Only a Game.
Oh, pleasure. Good to be here.
At Wimbledon last year, we had the number one and number two players facing each other in the final of the sport's most significant tournament, and the match went five sets. But that's only the beginning of what earned that confrontation the designation of greatest ever. For more, perhaps you could read your eloquent one-paragraph case for that distinction.
Tick off the classic sporting event checklist, and this match had it all. Skill, courage, self-sufficiency, sportsmanship, grace, discipline, gallantry, poise, intelligence, humility, injury, recovery, fibrillations of momentum, even acts of God. The match was also significant for what it lacked. It lacked melodrama, pornographic trash talk, cheating. There was neither a scoreboard telling fans when to clap, nor a public address announcer with a cartoonishly baritone voice. No cheerleaders, no goofy mascots, no booing, no piped-in music during breaks and play, or unnaturally peppy men firing T-shirts into the crowd via air cannon. The moral might be this: invest some dignity in a sporting event and everyone responds in kind.
Maybe even another bit of evidence is that the TV commentator, John McEnroe, said very little during the latter stages of the match. It must have been the greatest ever.
You know, he said later, these guys were so eloquent, what the heck was I going to add? But no, this was just one of these sporting events that you realize comes along, you know, once in a blue moon. And, you know, I think there was also so much context here. This was their third straight Wimbledon final, and you really had a sense no matter how this broke, the implications were going to be huge. Federer was really sort of the undisputed king for about 5 years. Nadal was really the first person to come along and say, you know what, second place isn't good enough for me. I'm really going to try and take you down. And so for them to come out and play this sensational match, 5 hours, ended in darkness, it really was, it sounds trite, but it really did seem so scripted.
In making the case for best ever, you discuss various activities that stopped while the tennis match was going on. Tell us a little bit about the evidence you discovered regarding the number of people paying attention to Federer versus Nadal last year.
You know, it started just sort of anecdotally when I told people I'd be, you know, I was working on this book, and they said, you know what? We were at a villa in France, and we had to postpone our dinner reservation 3 times because we couldn't pry ourselves from the TV. Tennis is obviously... at some level, it's a niche sport and it goes through its tough times. But for one sort of glorious afternoon, really, the world is not an exaggeration. The world revolved around tennis. And I kept hearing these sports. You know, Andy Roddick got off a plane in the Austin, Texas airport and he didn't even go to baggage claim. He just went to the bar TV in Austin, Texas. And in India, it was the middle of the night and a woman was, you know, sticking socks in her mouth so her screams wouldn't wake the neighbors. these stories just sort of came in, and it was really... Tennis does not become the new NFL because of this one match, but for one day anyway, tennis had a very special place sort of in global consciousness.
Were you at all reluctant to go the best ever route? Because, boy, we see a lot of books here at Only a Game that have best ever somewhere in the subtitle.
You know, it's funny because that was sort of my knee-jerk reaction to, can't something just sort of be virtuous in and of itself without the superlatives? But I figure once McEnroe and Borg, who were sort of the other candidates, once they quickly conceded that, yes, they had been supplanted and this match was the best ever, I didn't feel like it was so much of a stretch. It's funny you mentioned that because it actually was something that sort of stuck with me.
The feeling when Rafael Nadal knocked off Roger Federer at Wimbledon almost a year ago was that perhaps Nadal's time had come, and he did ascend to number one in the world. However, Federer won the French Open this spring. Did you feel at that time that the stars were lining up for another candidate for best ever match?
Well, something that was really gratifying, I mean, I think it sort of comes through in the pages that I have affection for both these guys. This is not the rivalry where you have the hero and the anti-hero and you love one and hate the other. But something that's really nice is that this rivalry still, it's very vital. It still is sort of evolving and growing. And you're absolutely right. We all thought this was Nadal's coronation, and yet Federer's won 2 of the 3 subsequent major titles. So I do think it's nice that this match didn't really end this rivalry. It just was sort of an interesting plot point.
There is a good deal in Strokes of Genius about how people bet on tennis these days, and I was surprised to read your contention that there are only 2 sports, horse racing and soccer, that inspire more gambling than tennis. How did you determine that?
Well, it's interesting. Tennis had been rocked by this gambling scandal a few years ago, and there's an online betting company, Betfair, based in the UK. It's actually a few miles from the All England Club. So a slow day of tennis, I got in the tube and actually went to Betfair's headquarters. And it's this thriving internet company. This online gambling, it's illegal in the United States, so we don't really have an equivalent. But this looks like your typical Silicon Valley startup. It's very shrewd what they do. It's not like a Vegas casino. It's basically more like sort of Match.com. It's like dating. And if I think Nadal's going to win, they find me a match, and if there isn't one, the bet doesn't go through. So they're really sort of, I think agnostic was the word they used. They don't care about the result. They just sort of pair you up with someone in the alternative camp, and they take a cut. You know, this is huge, huge business. And when Nadal and Federer were playing, these sort of gambling indicators were going all over the place. And it's not just I'm betting Federer will win. It's literally I'll bet he'll win this next point. There are all sorts of permutations of the bet. And it's all done. I mean, we don't have this in the U.S., but internationally, it's huge business.
I'm speaking with L. John Wertheim about his book, Strokes of Genius, and you're listening to Only a Game. You and Bud Collins have both compared tennis to boxing. What particular features of that Federer-Nadal match at Wimbledon last year justify that metaphor?
Well, it's just this incredibly gladiatorial. I mean, it's two guys out there, and there are no teammates you can blame, and it's as mental as much as it is physical, and you're the thrusting and the pairing. I mean, the one stark difference at Wimbledon, which I think still fascinates me, is Federer and Nadal shared a locker room. When I played basketball in middle school, we wouldn't think of getting dressed in the same locker room as the opposition. Here these two guys are, the biggest stage in the world for their sport, and it starts to rain, and they're literally sitting across the room from each other. So, no, tennis is it's intensely individual. You know, boxing, at least, you know, for a minute out of every four, you can at least go and repair to your corner and get toweled off and get instruction. I mean, here these guys can't even get coaching.
Rafael Nadal, of course, will not play at Wimbledon this time around. This is much to the dismay of people who would very much have liked to have seen Greatest Match, the sequel. Can you imagine, however, a greatest match between any other two players, Federer and somebody else, or two other guys entirely?
You know, I can't, in part because what made this such a great match, yes, qualitatively it was terrific, and there were very few errors, and it was very sort of clean and entertaining tennis, but I think a lot of what made this what it was the context and the build-up and the relationship between the two. I mean, you can't have – it's hard to imagine something lining up like that, you know, at least in the immediate future.
Finally, John, I have to say that one of my favorite parts of the new book comes at the end of the acknowledgments, when you thank the members of your family for their support while you spent, quote, three crazy months engrossed in tennis, and you follow that with, at least it wasn't cage fighting. Easy transition from that last book?
You like this one better?
I have to acknowledge that I do.
Yes. I joke that I covered a very intense individual sport that really leaves the combatants damaged, and I also covered cage fighting.
L. John Wertheim is the author of Strokes of Genius, Federer, Nadal, and the Greatest Match Ever Played. It's published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, and the author joined me from NPR's New York Bureau. John, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thanks. Always a pleasure.
You can take a closer listen to this week's stories, find a link to our weekly podcasts, or peruse our archives by visiting our website at onlyagame.org. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Account Temps, a global provider specializing in temporary staffing of accounting and finance professionals, locations worldwide. Details at accounttemps.com. And AVFX, Boston-based and serving the nation with audiovisual staging tools at corporate meetings, trade shows, and live events. Location information at avfx.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
If you can build something interesting and recognizable out of mashed-up French fries, you may have a future in Ocean City, New Jersey. 150 competitors took part in a French fry sculpting contest there last weekend, which suggests that the contest was successful enough to endure. Anybody can work in paint or clay, said Kevin Brown, who built a log cabin with a door and everything. But it takes a real artist to work in potatoes. Top prize went to Mary Beth Carroll of Winecote, Pennsylvania, for the bottle of wine, cheese balls, and crackers that she fashioned from soggy fries.
Under the boardwalk,
out of the sun.
Under the boardwalk,
we'll be having some fun.
Under the boardwalk,
people walking about.
Under the boardwalk,
we'll be falling in love.
Under the boardwalk.
I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, paddling down the pitch to put the ball in the net. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
Thursday night's NBA draft was already one of the least intriguing in recent memory, but the Clippers' number one pick of Oklahoma's Blake Griffin was greeted by even less fanfare than expected. Why was that?
Well, because, among other things, the Clippers had already built a marketing campaign around him 2 months ago. It was not an exceptionally charismatic draft. It was swamped by other events outside of Madison Square Garden, not only the trade of Shaquille O'Neal to Cleveland, but also the death of Michael Jackson. There was not a lot of interest in it to start with, and that sort of drained the rest of the air out of the room.
The intriguing thing to me was, of course, the Point Guards R Us franchise that opened up in Minneapolis. I suspect, although I can't prove this, that there may be serious talk about letting Ricky Rubio play out the last year of his deal in Spain, since you've backed up your rookie point guard thing with Nick Calathes and Johnny Flynn, and maybe bringing him over here in a couple of years.
Those who were thinking about basketball on Thursday night were focused on the guy who was drafted first in 1992, Shaquille O'Neal. Have the Cleveland Cavaliers become your pick for the 2009-2010 champs?
They're going to mess with the NBA's Eastern Conference in a big way here. This is quite a move for the big Aristotle. What will he be in Cleveland, by the way? The big Cuyahoga?
Maybe the big Lake Monster.
The big Lake Monster? I don't know. He can't be the big Cacus. That's what he was in Phoenix. he will step aside. He had a good year. He was an all-star last year. I will guarantee you that, among other things, the pregame warm-ups will be something you don't want to miss with the Cavaliers now.
I hate to bring this up, but Thursday night also proved to at least one sports figure that he should be much more careful about what he tweets, don't you think?
I think they should all be banned from tweeting for a while until they get the hang of the whole thing. You know what? People will see it! Mm-hmm. So if you're Chad Ochocinco and you tweet that Ms. Fawcett, now Mr. Jackson, please tell me this is a mistaken rumor. If not, this is just as sad as 9/11. People will see it. Don't do it. Take their electronic devices away from them.
In a news conference this week, incoming USC men's head basketball coach
and former Marquette mentor.
Yes, well, I'll get that in there. Kevin O'Neal said, "I want to be able to continue the good things that Tim Floyd has done here. I'm just hoping that Coach O'Neal keeps his focus on the things that his employer and the NCAA would define as good."
Yeah, I think he says the attraction to the job was simple. They major in graduation and championships here. Wait, hold on.
Hey,
time out. They haven't done either one of them for the last 4 or 5 years. That's why your predecessor isn't there anymore.
Manny Ramirez continued to serve his 50-game suspension from Major League Baseball this week, Charlie, by playing with the minor league Albuquerque Isotopes, though apparently Manny's need to find his swing does not include a need to find his swing after it rains.
Yeah, although it does rain in New Mexico, this is an interesting thing.
Everybody was celebrating.
And he will now be moving on to Class A Lake Elsinore, which I wonder if he'll be in there for the traditional game against Dunsinane in the Shakespearean minor leagues. Don't go near the parapets in the outfield, though. It's very scary at Elsinore Stadium.
Especially when ghosts start appearing along, yes. Another
major leaguer. I thought our listeners would be able to figure that out themselves.
I like to help them out whenever I can.
Thank you very much.
Another major leaguer.
Stupid.
Another major leaguer caught in a doping scandal is Alex Rodriguez, who's starting to emerge from an early summer slump. I guess that'll teach the folks who were already debating whether the 34-year-old A-Rod was getting old or just was not quite as good as previously thought.
Yeah, he's coming out of it a little bit thanks to the Atlanta Braves and the fact that he's on the road, which I think helps. Although they did play an old Madonna favorite, apparently, when he came to bat, which is sort of a little bit tweak at him. But yeah, I would suspect that he's back on the rails again.
Donald Fehr, the head of the Major League Baseball Players Association, announced his retirement on Monday. Will this change anything in the relationship between the players and the owners next time the two sides square off?
Well, I think it all depends on Michael Weiner, the new executive director, how deft he is with the power he has. Well, there was a lot of talk, you recall, when Marvin Miller left that the Players Association wouldn't have the power it once had. That was pretty much proven incorrect under Fehr. It all depends on the guy that takes over.
The U.S. men's soccer team will play defending champion Brazil in the finals of the Confederations Cup tournament tomorrow in South Africa. After some dismal play early in the tournament, the U.S. upset Spain 2-0 to get to the finals. A result with far-reaching consequences or a fluke?
I think on the result with far-reaching consequences, it's been a big story all week. I think it'll continue to be a big story right until the moment, I'm afraid, when Brazil beats them about 17-0 in the final.
It was 3-0 last time.
The really interesting thing to me is that the coach's son won't get to play. Michael Bradley got thrown out. He got red-carded out of the next game. What a bummer.
The Dallas Morning News broke the story before the selection committee made it official that Brett Hull will be inducted into the National Hockey League Hall of Fame, Charlie. Luckily, they were right about that because they were wrong in their assertion that this is the first time a player has followed his father into the Hockey Hall, but it's still pretty cool. A couple of generations of Hulls in there.
Yeah, there's Lester Patrick and Lynn Patrick. They're the Hewitts. They're the Norrises. These are all owners, by the way. I think the Hulls count more in the history of hockey than the Irvins or the Norrises or the Hewitts, as great as I thought Foster Hewitt was. It's a good class. Foster Hewitt, he was the Grand Old Opry of Canada, Hockey Night in Canada, my
Splendid.
Man. It's a great class, by the way. Steve Yzerman, Brian Leetch, Luke Robitaille. It's a cast of hockey players a lot of people have heard of.
Speaking of family connections in sports, some kid named Woods made her LPGA debut this week, though after shooting a 3-over par 75 in the first round, maybe Ms. Cheyenne Woods should get some tips from her slightly better-known uncle?
That's interesting. She's a sophomore at Wake Forest. She's a very talented player. 75 is certainly not a bad score for your first professional round. The very most interesting thing about it is that she is the daughter of Earl Woods Jr., who is one of the children of Earl Woods' first marriage, who were practically invisible in the long arc of the Tiger Woods story. So now this is going to make people confront that little bit of history, too. I think she's going to be fine.
And finally, Charlie,
I love this.
In a move that may have fans of a certain age recalling the rap efforts of the Chicago Bears 23 years ago, three members of the Dallas Cowboys are going to be doing some singing. You looking forward to the debut of Free Reign?
If you were an NFL offensive lineman, you're putting a band together, it has to be a metal band, right? I mean, NFL offensive linemen are not like singer-songwriters. They're not twee little alternative rock bands from the University of Georgia. You're banging heads. You bang heads for a living. Why wouldn't you be a headbanger in your night job, too? I'm looking forward to this, by God, and I can still make the gang signs.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine, and he joins me each week at this time on Only a Game as well. I thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
We love the good Dallas Cowboys, the best of the good times that we've ever had. We love the good Dallas Cowboys, hell, we love them when they were bad.
I loved playing for the Fighting Illini, and I appreciate the support I was given by my teammates, coaches, and the great fans here, but I have come to the point where I'm ready to focus on life after basketball. For any Division I college player to say such a thing would be unusual, given how many Division I college basketball players choose their colleges with basketball opportunities in mind. You can hear some of them calculating, how soon will I earn a starting spot? How well will this coach understand my unique talents? How often will my games be televised? Is this program likely to get me picked high in the NBA draft? That the young man talking and apparently thinking about academics and life after basketball should be Jeff Jordan, son of Michael Jordan, is especially intriguing. According to his coach at Illinois, Jeff Jordan will be missed. He brought a great work ethic, and he pushed himself and his teammates every day to improve, Coach Bruce Weber said, but we fully support the decision he has made. I am not acquainted with Jeff Jordan. I don't know what he's studying, and I have no idea what he has in mind when he refers to life after basketball, but I respect his point of view. I do know that Jordan was a star player in high school, and that after walking on at Illinois, he played well enough to earn himself a basketball scholarship, though his father probably could have handled the tuition. Anyway, that a young man who had taken basketball seriously for that many years should choose to look beyond the game while he could have still played should invite any number of sensible young athletes to focus on concerns other than basketball, or football, or hockey, or baseball, precisely because they understand that they won't be playing games forever. This is not to suggest that Michael Jordan did anything wrong in playing basketball brilliantly for many years, earning millions and millions of dollars along the way, but so few among even the very best prospects have the opportunity to do that, and so many delude themselves into thinking they can. On the other hand, a great many young men and women have the chance to play games at a competitive level and then move beyond that arena to, as Jeff Jordan put it, life after basketball. Maybe that assertion of personal determination will encourage some of those young athletes to be like Jeff rather than be like Mike.
Like Mike.
Kayak polo, or canoe polo as it's known internationally, is a popular sport in Europe and Australia. It's a bit more obscure here in America. Kayak polo enthusiasts want to change that, but with the next World Championship tourney only a year away, they have their work cut out for them. From the home of the nation's largest kayak polo club, Martin Wells reports.
All right, and then on defense, just make sure they don't get past the flags here. Push them out, push them out, push them out.
Dan Randall, leader of the Omaha-based Nebraska Kayak Polo Club, calls out commands as players steady their kayaks in the water. It's Friday night at the Prairie Life Fitness Center, and the excitement is building.
Go!
10 helmeted and padded men and women wearing life vests zip around a 25-yard-long indoor swimming pool in 6-foot kayaks. A bright yellow and blue ball about the size of a volleyball is passed back and forth as players try to hurl it into a net suspended 6 feet in the air on each end of the pool. Every now and then, a kayak flips over after a player is shoved hard or tackled. Randall says the really good players can right themselves immediately.
Easier said than done, though. It's kind of like learning a nice, smooth golf swing, except for you're underwater and you can't breathe and everything's upside down. So,
but other than that, it's pretty simple.
Yeah, right.
The Nebraska Kayak Polo Club has over 80 members, making it the largest in the nation and accounting for perhaps as many as 1/5 of all regular U.S. kayak polo players. And that's one of the biggest challenges kayak polo faces. Not many people play it, perhaps 300 to 400 in the whole country. Chris Sewell is the president of the Carolina Kayak Polo Club. Speaking by phone from Charlotte, Sewell says it's hard to recruit polo players when there are lots of other canoe and kayak sports to choose from.
For example, here in the Carolinas, there's lots of white water, and you can do white water kayaking all year round. So the challenge we face as a club is recruiting people that like to kayak but also want to do polo as opposed to white water.
Sewell, who's also chair of the U.S. Canoe Kayak Polo Committee, says Europeans have embraced the sport. Nearly every major European city has a kayak polo club. That puts the U.S. at a disadvantage when competing in world championships, which are held every 2 years.
Even though it's great for us as a country to go and participate because we do learn a lot, and the people that go can bring those skills that they've learned back to their clubs and to the polo community in general, we're not that good at the sport on a world level.
The key difference between us and the other countries is they have a lot of younger players starting, you know, in their teens. And they start competing internationally when they're, you know, in their early 20s and the peak of their fitness.
47-year-old Adrian Nye of Austin, Texas, was a member of last year's U.S. team that competed in the World Championships.
For us, it's so far been a lot of older paddlers, like in their 30s, that already know whitewater paddling, and they pick up polo and they start competing, and they're close to 40 by the time they get good enough for the world level, and we just get killed because our fitness and our throwing is not good enough.
So in the patriotic spirit of boosting America's competitiveness, this reporter decides to give kayak polo a try. By way of full disclosure, I'm a good swimmer, and I've paddled a few canoes in my day, but I've never been in a kayak, primarily because of my fear of being trapped upside down underwater. So the first thing Dan Randall teaches me is how to get out of that predicament, or in kayak polo terms, do a wet exit. The most important thing, he says, is to remain calm.
If we see any panicking at all, we ask that you do it a couple more times just to kind of get the hang of being upside down and knowing where you are underwater.
All right, it would seem to me that panicking when you're upside down and underwater would be the right response.
Yeah. Well, we'll see what happens. Yes, it is. You'd be surprised, though. We have some people that are pretty cool with it.
Dan and his wife, Susan, calm my fears, get me suited up, and go over the rules.
Really, really basic. Don't touch anyone's boat, paddle, and if you're going to tackle them, it's done with a
open hand
to the shoulder.
So you're not allowed to grab.
No grabbing. Take your hand and shove them in the shoulder.
The Randalls help me into a spray skirt, which is worn around the waist and stretched over the kayak opening to keep the water out, then shove my kayak into the pool and I do a wet exit. After the kayak tips over, I reach forward, pull the spray skirt release cord and slide my legs out of the boat, bumping my shins in the process. After a couple of tries, Dan and Susan declare me ready.
The first game of the night is usually the Malheur game where people aren't out for blood so much. As the night wears on, the games get a little more competitive in a really good-natured way. We're all pretty tight-knit group, so there's not a lot of heat out there.
Not going to be a lot of blood in the pool tonight?
No. Not if the chlorine's doing its job.
Dan Randall's just kidding, right? Chris Sewell tells me not to worry.
It looks like an aggressive game. It is fairly aggressive, but it's a good way to get some of that aggression out after a stressful day at work. However, it's very safe.
Former U.S. team coach and player Mark Poindexter agrees.
I got hurt way more in soccer than I ever did this, although this looks like a more violent game because boats are colliding and, you know, you're wearing face masks for protection from the paddles and stuff. But, again, I've never really been seriously hurt in this game at 11 years.
After one game of kayak polo, I'm tired and sore, but also exhilarated. Susan Randall helps me over to a chair.
So Who won that game? Without my glasses, I couldn't even hardly see what was going on.
The team you were on, the team you and I were on.
We won.
Yeah.
What was the score?
I have no idea. We don't keep score. That led to trouble.
So kayak polo is a fun sport, even for the novice. However, U.S. player Adrian Nye says to compete at the world level, it's going to take a lot of hard work.
To be at the world level, you got to be physically incredible. You got to train really hard. I mean, the people that do it, the winning clubs, they paddle at least once a day, probably twice. I mean, it's a serious sport, even though it's an obscure sport. To be at the top, you got to train that hard.
For Only a Game, I'm Martin Wells in Lincoln, Nebraska.
I'm cold and wet.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Perotti. Our intern is Josh Levenshurst. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. If you'd like to view Martin Wells' kayak polo photo gallery, download our weekly podcasts, learn more about the music you hear on our program, or listen to stories past and present, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word is from kayak polo reporter Martin Wells. Oh, there goes another perfectly good microphone. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. See you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.